Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and not long ago I went over to Bard College, which is not far from where I live, to hear a talk about a book. And I went almost for the novelty of it, because here was a whole book being written about the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and I thought, wow, I wonder what that's going to be about. And I have to tell you, it was a fascinating talk, and I wanted to share some of it with you, and I want to encourage you to check out this book. It's called Message to Our Folks, and it's by Paul Steinbeck. He's an assistant professor of music theory at Washington University in St. Louis. The book was published by the University of Chicago, and it's cool. Let me just say that. So welcome, Paul.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thanks for setting this up. I'm always happy to talk about the Art Ensemble of Chicago.
You know what? You know, I got the opportunity to see them in the 80s, and I saw Lester Boyd perform a lot. I think his band was called Brass Fantasy. And, you know, yeah. When you're young and you're seeing all this stuff, you never give any thought to the question of how did they pull this off? They were not playing, quote, popular music. I mean, they certainly found a fan base, but this wasn't easy music to, quote, sell. And to keep the band together and to keep developing and to keep building things and making things and evolving. And there's a whole logistics behind that, and that was one of the things that you got into in your talk. So maybe we could go through the history of the group. I'm going to assume everybody has at least heard of the Art Ensemble of Chicago. So, of course, they started in Chicago, I assume.
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised. I hadn't realized that they started so long ago, but they got rolling in 1966.
Yeah. So if you heard them in the 80s, they were, you know, already a decade or two into their history. But yes, the band performed its first gig under the name of the Art Ensemble in December 1966. But actually, the roots go back a few years earlier. The early members of the Art Ensemble all belonged to the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, which was founded in 1965. And even before that, people like Roscoe Mitchell and Malachi Favors and Joseph Jarman were all in college together in the early 60s. So we're talking about a group whose, you know, members coming together or getting to know, you know, one another really goes back almost 55 years, and they're still performing in 2017. Not all of the original members are still around, but they have been doing this for a long time, and they continue to do it, which is really remarkable. There aren't too many groups in the history of music that can boast that kind of longevity.
No, not at all. Not at all. And they started in the mid-60s when, you know, jazz was sort of under attack in a way, you know, with the rock and roll boom. And, you know, so some of the interest in jazz had faded. And yet they staked out this very challenging creative space. So some of them met in college, and then they became members of the AACM, which is a Chicago-based organization, I think.
Yeah.
And then they
Roscoe Mitchell, Malachi Favors, and Joseph Jarman all met in college at a community college on Chicago's South Side. They were studying music education ostensibly, but they were really there just to learn music and play in the orchestra. And they discovered that they had a rapport, and they were interested in the same kinds of jazz and experimental music. Ornette Coleman was a big early inspiration. Various 20th century modernists and post-tonal composers were also inspirational for some of the members of the group. And so it was only natural that in 1965 they would join up with the AACM, which was all about producing opportunities for African-American musicians who were thinking of themselves as composers just as much as performers. So getting away from the jazz model or a popular music model and more into a model of concerts and producing concerts, writing original music, performing original music. So that was the AACM's mission from 1965 on to the present day. And, of course, the AACM is still very much alive. And when people like Roscoe Mitchell and Malachi Favors started forming their own groups, it was very much with that AACM aesthetic of original music and that AACM philosophy of doing things for yourself. And that was how the Art Ensemble survived for the first decade or two, because there wasn't much of a market for experimental music. The jazz market was cratering a bit. And the Art Ensemble wasn't even trying to be a jazz band. They called themselves an art ensemble, not a jazz ensemble or something like that. So they're trying to be beyond jazz, beyond concert music, really beyond anything, getting into the intersection of music and performance art and visuals and poetry and theater, all these different things. It's wonderful to experience if you're in the audience, but it's not something that already had a sort of predetermined market segment set up. So they had to arrange their own concerts. They had to pay their own way to Paris in 1969. They had to do all kinds of things economically, financially, and on a personal level to stay together until the 70s. Finally, midway through the 70s, they really started hitting their stride where they could perform across the U.S. and across Europe and even go to Japan and across the world. So by then, they really had something that they knew they could keep going. But even before that, you know, they were so committed that it was not a question. Failure was not an option. It was just a question of how they were going to survive.
It was such a bold vision, you know, just, you know, if we try to put ourselves in their shoes, you know, there was no precedent for what they were attempting, and it didn't faze them. They just decided they were going to do it, and off they went. What were those early years like? And then I want to talk a little bit about that important trip they took to Paris. But how did they hold themselves together in the very early days of the group?
You know, it was the thing that held them together for the entire history. It was all about the music, all about performing and rehearsing. And so some of the early members of the group, like Roscoe Mitchell, had other jobs. Malachi Favors was playing sort of standard jazz gigs. Lester Bowie was doing a lot of studio work, recordings, things like that. But, you know, that's not round the clock, any of those jobs. So whenever they had some time off, and they tried to get time off every single day, they would just be in somebody's apartment or basement rehearsing for hours on end. And so it was that, you know, the pull of the music that brought them all together and kept them involved. Now, they did perform whenever they could. That might be, you know, once a month or a few times a year. So they weren't really in Chicago in the 60s making any real money, but they were performing as often as they could, and it was just tantalizing enough to make them want to go farther. But they realized they couldn't make a living only in Chicago. And so in 1969, they had been corresponding with a drummer and producer over in Paris, and there was already an AACM member over in Europe, Steve McCall, one of the founders. He had been in Paris and Amsterdam and all kinds of places as early as 1967 and 1968. So they did know from one of their colleagues that it was possible to make a living performing jazz and experimental music in Europe, but McCall was just solo, whereas the Art Ensemble, they were going to take the entire band and then, you know, have that band be their primary means of support. So it's very different than being a freelancer and picking up gigs with 5 or 10 different bands in the course of a month. If you're trying to do it as a group, then that's a whole other level of economic commitment. You know, you really have to scramble to find all the work for the group so all the members of the group can survive. They also discovered they had to engage in economic cooperation, so they had to share a residence and share a lot of their expenses. That's what really allowed them in Paris to then, you know, be able to pay their bills and actually, you know, make a little bit of money and save a little bit of money. So from 1969 to 1971, the Art Ensemble was over in Europe, based in Paris, but they also traveled across the continent, and that's where they really became the Art Ensemble in terms of their economic and social model, you know, doing things cooperatively, you know, sharing expenses and sharing income so they could prosper collectively.
Gotcha. So previous to that, when they were in Chicago, you know, they were individually making their livings any way they could. And did you say that they attempted to rehearse every day if possible?
Yes, at least 5 or 6 days a week, you know, several hours, you know, whenever they had a block of time, it was time to rehearse. So, you know, they were really deeply invested in creating new modes of musical performance, new relationships between composition and improvisation. So the Art Ensemble, when they're performing or just rehearsing, it wasn't about playing All the Things You Are or Stella by Starlight or any jazz standard, or it wasn't about playing classical music in the standard way. They weren't trying to do anything that had been done before. So if you're going to invent new types of composition, if you're going to invent new methods of group improvisation, if you're going to be bringing a bunch of unorthodox instruments into your music making, then you just have to put in the time. So these guys would rehearse for several hours a day, just about every day, you know, just trying to establish a feeling among themselves that they could, you know, then take to the stage whenever it was time. So this was basically a daily workshop they put themselves through for several years, and it led to the group being, you know, one of the most cohesive and, you know, exploratory and far-reaching, you know, improvising groups in music history because they just put the time in.
Yeah, it's so valuable to understand this background, to know where things come from, and to realize that even before they were getting gigs, I mean, maybe a gig every month or every couple of months, they were still meeting every day, or at least, you know, every day they possibly could, to spend hours playing. And this is a good lesson for aspiring musicians, young musicians, of course, that the performances that you see are really just the tip of the iceberg. And that seems to really be the case in the case of this band. And it kind of reminds me of Ornette's story, because I know he and Don Cherry and others did a whole lot of playing before anybody ever invited them to come and play for the public. So, and I think this is very valuable information for fans too, because we see the finished product. We don't see all that goes into it. And in this case, the extraordinary commitment on the parts of all the members. Now, you mentioned something really interesting when in your talk at BART. When they were in Paris, they made the decision to rent one house and basically share the expenses and have a base where they could rehearse and live and operate out of.
Yeah, that was the way they figured out that they had to do it. I mean, when they first got to Paris, the first few weeks they were, you know, going from hotel to hotel, doing that sort of thing. But, you know, that gets pretty expensive even in late 60s Paris, which wasn't, you know, as pricey of a city as it is now. But they just discovered that even though they were working a lot in Paris, you know, immediately they were playing concerts a few nights a week. So, you know, maybe an order of magnitude or two beyond their concert schedule back in Chicago. But even that, you know, was playing for, you know, a couple hundred people at a time, and, you know, it wasn't really paying big bucks. So they had to figure out a way to economize. They needed, you know, a space to rehearse every day, and they were earning all their money together anyhow. That was their commitment. So why not spend it together? So that was the innovation they developed. It was really unique among other expatriate bands in Paris. There were a lot of American groups and American freelancers, you know, coming over in the late 60s, but the Art Ensemble was perhaps the only group to really take their collective commitment, you know, to the highest level in terms of their, you know, their economics and their living situation. So that strategy allowed the group to save a lot of money and allowed them to keep rehearsing every day like they had done back in Chicago, and it, you know, allowed their music to just be out of this world. If you're rehearsing every single day and you're having meals together and all that, you're just going to be more united. And a lot of groups didn't have that type of collective feeling. The Art Ensemble certainly did. So whenever they were ready to go out and play that concert a few nights a week, or, you know, go to Germany and play this show, they were so ready because they spent all day every day getting ready for their next concert.
Mm. And of course, the audiences could, even if they didn't know all the details, they could sense that cohesiveness and responded in kind, and I guess it created sort of a snowballing effect in Europe, you know, starting in Paris, but then the demand for their music springing up in other places. What other countries did they play in during that period when they were first in Paris?
Well, they were based in Paris, as you said. They started performing all across France in 1970, and also in 1971 they did these, you know, multi-week tours of the entire country through the French Ministry of Culture. So at the time, the French Ministry of Culture was financing the construction of culture houses in, you know, every medium to large size, you know, town or city in France. So there are all these new concert halls or art centers being built, and they were, of course, looking for musical groups or other attractions to put in those places. So the French government, you know, set up the Art Ensemble on a couple of tours. You know, they might go to 30 cities in a couple of months. So when they were finally, you know, really getting that mass audience in France and the rest of Europe, they were on tour constantly in 1970 and 71. They also went, you know, from Germany and Switzerland and Italy and all through Scandinavia. So basically everywhere west of the Soviet bloc, you know, they performed during that two-year period from 1969 to 1971.
Wow. And those of us who are, you know, we have listeners all over the world, but for our American listeners, especially if you haven't had a chance to travel to Europe, governments actually do support the arts. They actually go out of their way to, you know, encourage arts in their communities. So there was an infrastructure for this kind of thing that didn't really exist in the U.S. at that time. I can't really think. I mean, there were lofts in New York City, but of course, those were privately owned. I don't know. I'm trying to think of who in this period was encouraging or providing a platform, a stage for this kind of music in the United States. And I'm a little hard pressed to think of anything, you know, some certain spaces in New York City, and probably I'm sure other city, American cities too, but you certainly didn't have a network of, did you call them culture houses?
Yeah. Maison de culture, something like that. So
yeah.
But that was something the French government instituted. I think probably the only thing even halfway comparable would be the international tours that the U.S. State Department funded, where they would send jazz bands or other American performing arts ensembles, like, you know, dance companies, to various parts of the world. And so that was something that some very prominent jazz musicians like Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie were able to take advantage of. But that was done internationally, not within the U.S. Maybe another comparison, universities, some of which, of course, are state-supported or federally funded in part. So the art ensemble in the 60s and 70s and even in the 80s did perform at a lot of universities, a lot of college campuses. But again, those were opportunities they had to make for themselves like they had always done. They weren't getting calls from, you know, from somebody in D.C., you know, giving them a six-week tour schedule like actually happened in France. So a little bit of a different scene. But they were definitely in Europe in the right time. If they had gone a few decades later, a lot of countries' arts funding schemes changed where they were favoring domestic talent more so than, you know, say, American musicians in France. So it's a little harder now to do it, but the art ensemble went over at exactly the right point in history. They took full advantage of everything, you know, that they could take advantage of, and they really laid a foundation for not just themselves, but plenty of other groups, whether it was AACM bands or just other groups from the States to come over to Europe and do the kinds of things the art ensemble did.
Oh, I'm sure they helped open a lot of doors with all that they did over there. You told an interesting story about their transportation, and just because I guess the older I get, the more fascinated I become by logistics of jazz. You know how do people make it work? So tell us about how they handled their transportation challenges in Europe.
Yeah, well, they just like with everything else, the art ensemble got creative. So when they moved from Chicago to Paris in 1969, they actually took two vehicles. So they made the transatlantic journey on a ship, you know, rather than flying, for instance. So Malachi Favors brought his Volkswagen van and Lester Bowie brought his motorcycle. And that was enough for getting around Paris, even with the hundreds of musical instruments that they had. But when they added a fifth member to the group, Don Moyer, who was originally from Rochester, New York, college in Detroit, he moved to Europe in 1969, actually before the art ensemble, working with a Detroit-based band. That broke up. He was working with Americans like Steve Lacy after that. By early 1970, he had made his way into the art ensemble. So from the original four who crossed the Atlantic, Roscoe Mitchell, Malachi Favors, Lester Bowie, Joseph Jarman, they now had a fifth member who had just as many drums and percussion instruments as everybody else in the art ensemble. So one van, as big as it was definitely not going to do it. So because the members of the group were, you know, living, you know, in a collective space and saving a lot of money, they were able to buy about three Ford Transits, these, you know, sort of work trucks that you still see on the road in Europe as well as the States. And they had basically this fleet. And so they could use that fleet to go from their suburban rented home into Paris, or they could use it to go from, you know, Paris to another place in France or another place across Europe. So they had a whole fleet. They traveled in style. Sometimes they would camp out along the side of the road if the weather was nice, and they'd, you know, grill, you know, they'd set up some grills next to their trucks and everything. They really had a different model. They were traveling like rock bands, essentially, because they had, you know, the amount of equipment that a rock band might have, but they were just playing, you know, experimental music rather than, you know, some other stuff. And
sure,
that lasted them through their 2 years in Europe, 69 to 71. When they came back to the U.S. in 71, they took their Ford trucks, but eventually that wasn't, you know, big enough for the kinds of touring they got into in the U.S. by the mid-70s. So then they went to General Motors in Detroit and bought a rehabbed Greyhound bus, and they had this big bus that they then used, you know, across the U.S. from the mid-70s. For quite some time. I was in Chicago just last week, and Ed Wilkerson of the AACM mentioned how in 1977, when basically every AACM musician from Chicago came to New York for a four-day music festival, the art ensemble volunteered the use of their tour bus. So, you know, 40 musicians from Chicago were able to climb into that thing and bring all their instruments. So The Art Ensemble was always happy to share their resources with other people, but for them it was just absolutely transformative to have, you know, serious ground transportation in Europe or in the U.S. It allowed them to do all the touring that they did and take all their instruments, and it was just another way of traveling and doing things together.
What a great story about them volunteering the bus as a vehicle for all those Chicago musicians to get to New York. That's great. If you think of the airfare times 40 guys, that saved tens of thousands of dollars probably. Logistics. You know, and if anybody has never seen the Art Ensemble, Paul mentioned something really important. They have a lot of instruments on stage. You know, it's maybe you could do, maybe you, since you wrote about them, and you could you describe, let's say somebody's never seen even a picture of the band, what would it look like? What would do the stages look like when they're set up to play?
Wow, well, it looks like nothing you've seen before. First of all, maybe it looks like the entire contents of an orchestra storage room, or maybe an entire music store just, you know, all laid out on a stage. When the Art Ensemble initially got together, they were definitely inspired by, you know, the music of people like Ornette Coleman. So there were saxophones in the group and trumpets and basses and drums and things like that. But coming from the AACM, they were really more interested in multi-instrumentalism. So playing as many instruments as they could and developing textures, musical textures, that were almost orchestral in scope or in potential. So now there were never 80 members of the Art Ensemble like you might get in a standard symphony orchestra, but they had as many or more instruments, you know, as a symphony might have. So instead of playing, you know, one or two saxophones, Roscoe Mitchell and Joseph Jarman would play the entire saxophone family and the entire flute family. And, you know, Joseph Jarman was really heavy into bassoon for a while. And, of course, they all played percussion instruments. You know, Lester Bowie was playing trumpet, but also flugelhorn and all kinds of percussion instruments. Malachi Favors was playing string bass, but also electric bass guitar and zither, and all kinds of percussion instruments. And Don Moyer was playing drum set and kungas and bongos and all kinds of hand drums and African drums and gongs from all over the world and bells from all over the world. So we're just talking about basically the entire family of instruments in just about any, you know, music style that you can think of, from a rock band to an Asian gamelan ensemble, to an orchestra, to a jazz group. They had everything on stage all together. So it just meant that in the course of performance, they could go from one style of music to another style of music. In the course of a group improvisation, they could have so many different options for instrumental combinations because they just had literally hundreds of instruments on stage with them at all times. And that any sound that they heard in their minds, they could, you know, just go to that instrument and play that sound, bring that out. So it was really a revolutionary way of thinking about instrumentation in a small group concept. And there have been other AACM groups who've gotten into some of that, but no group collectively has done as much with multi-instrumentalism and percussion as the Art Ensemble of Chicago.
Yeah, I encourage everybody to do a image search on Google for Art Ensemble and just see all that they had on stage with them. You know, which this is a silly question, but I suddenly am curious. Did they have any roadies? I mean, who set these stages up for them? Because just setting up the stage looked like it would have been a multi-hour process by itself.
Hey, it certainly was, but they were very organized. I mean, that's one thing about people like Roscoe Mitchell and Don Moyer and Lester Bowie. These are planners extraordinaire. So they had, you know, diagrams for the stage setup and all kinds of things that you would need to have if you were using roadies or just a local crew. But during the late 60s and early 70s, they did it all themselves. They didn't really have the money at that point to hire additional crew. So it might take a couple hours to set up for a concert and maybe another hour or two to break everything down. So it was a major commitment, but it was so integral to their music that they couldn't really imagine doing it any other way. The only period in their career where they really didn't take their instruments all the time is in, you know, maybe the late 70s or mid 80s when they were going to Europe flying. Sometimes it was difficult, you know, to be traveling from the U.S. to Europe or to Japan, you know, on a plane. But you know, by the early 80s, they purchased these flight cases, these custom-made flight cases where they could take all their instruments and their concert wardrobes and their, you know, office supplies and all that stuff. So they found ways to do that even when they moved in the direction of air travel rather than, you know, rather than going on the water or on the roads. So logistics were always a theme, always something the art ensemble had to take into account, but it allowed their music to be completely unique, and it just allowed the visual presentation on the stage to be completely unique, because no other bands were coming into the concert hall with, you know, 400 instruments on a Saturday night. That just wasn't happening. If that was going on, it was the art ensemble.
And I guess, you know, now maybe some of that could be replicated with via digital means, but these guys did it the old-fashioned way with instruments in hand. One of the things that was discussed as part of your talk, Thurman Barker, who's the professor at Bard that invited you to come and speak, we were talking about Chicago. Art ensemble is utterly unique, and yet Chicago also gave birth to a similar but different collective, Sun Ra and his orchestra. And then more contemporary, you have Steve Coleman and M-Bass, and he's out of the New York City area now, but he also has a collective vision, not similar to the way the art ensemble works, but, you know, a group of people that are free-floating and they come together when possible to do projects and then go off on their own and come back. And we were speculating, why Chicago, you know, why has Chicago produced these interesting units? And Chris Barker says something that I didn't even realize. I can't believe I didn't know this, but Chicago had the biggest black population in all of the United States. Being a New Yorker, I always thought it had to be New York. And he pointed out that this self-reliance and this entrepreneurship and this organization and this creating of organizations and operating of organizations really thrived in the city of Chicago. And that the art ensemble was probably drawing from all those experiences. So I don't know. It's just a very interesting thing that this one city should produce so many music collectives that are so ambitious and so artistically successful. Now, you mentioned that the art ensemble continues to this day. What's the current – unfortunately, we lost the great Lester Bowie, who I think was one of the great – I would put him right up there with Louis Armstrong. Now, people may say that's extreme, but I can't help it. I think his trumpet playing was incredible. What's the configuration of the band now, and how are they touring and working in these days?
Well, there are three original members of the band still on this planet: Roscoe Mitchell, Famidou Don Moyer, and Joseph Jarman. Joseph Jarman isn't in the right health condition right now to be touring, but Roscoe Mitchell and Famidou Don Moyer are still very much apart. They've been using guest musicians on and off for several years. So when they were in London back in February of 2017, the guests were Hugh Reagan on trumpet, various trumpets, and Junius Paul out of Chicago on bass and percussion. So they performed as a quartet. Hugh Reagan has been working with Roscoe Mitchell since the 70s. Junius Paul has been working with Roscoe for several years. So they all have familiarity, at least with Roscoe Mitchell. And, of course, anybody who's around Roscoe or working with him is going to become an art ensemble fan and a serious student of the group, because it's just, you know, such an integral part of Roscoe's, you know, ongoing legacy. So two original members, two guests playing, you know, broadly in the art ensemble style that you may have, you know, encountered in the 1980s, but it's also contemporary because the art ensemble always evolved. They were always studying and incorporating new styles of music, always doing some different things. So you could also think about this as just the next stage in the art ensemble's evolution. They're going to be in Norway and Italy and the UK at later points in 2017. So if you're anywhere near those areas, please, you know, check your schedule and check the concert listings and go and hear the art ensemble doing what they do.
That's great. So the demand they created over all those years lives on. People still recognize the name. They know what it stands for. Like you pointed out,
right,
it evolves because they're artists, but they know it's going to evolve in a way that's good, you know, a way that's really worth listening and worth pursuing. You know, in addition to being musicians, they also had a very strong theatrical bent. You know, for example, costumes, face paint, different, instruments from different parts of the world, poetry. I think they even did sketches, like little skits almost, or theatrical pieces. Can you talk about what that was about and how did that fit into their overall vision?
I think their vision was, you know, forms of performance that are just, you know, integrating all the other different forms of art. So music was always at the center, but they were definitely into the visual side that you could get in theater, but also in other styles of music making or other styles of performance art. Poetry was very important, especially to Joseph Jarman, also to Roscoe Mitchell. And, you know, these guys were just students of all the performance traditions. So Joseph Jarman tells stories of, you know, traveling to Morocco and seeing some of the music and dance and theater performances they do over there and wanting to bring that approach into the art ensemble. Joseph also studied, you know, improv theater back in the 60s, so he wanted to bring those sketches and, you know, those approaches into the band. All these guys just were serious students of performance art, of music, of all the different disciplines. So anything that seemed like the art ensemble could do, they would bring it into the group, you know. So they were just really thinking about art and music in a very broad, comprehensive fashion. And that, you know, that's another thing that made their music and made their performances so unique. It wasn't just play this tune and that tune. Anything could happen when the art ensemble took the stage. And so that element of surprise, that element of multidimensionality was really, you know, was really at the center of their aesthetic.
And it was also a surprise to them. I mean, they had patterns and plans and structures, but they weren't playing off a fixed score. And within what they were doing, they always had the freedom to create something within the structure that had never been done before.
Right. These guys were improvisers, you know, and of course, improvisation is something that happens not just in music, but a lot of other art forms. So if you think of the understructure that was behind everything they did on stage or in the recording studio, I think improvisation is probably the key word. And sometimes they would improvise with musical instruments. Sometimes they would use their voices, or sometimes they would, you know, bring some improvised sort of theater dialogue in there. Other times they would just, you know, the way that they would change their face paint from concert to concert, that's an element of improvisation or spontaneity or being responsive to the moment. So I think improvisation is the, you know, the theme that's at the core of everything the art ensemble did, and it just showed up in a lot of different facets, a lot of different areas.
You know, and it goes without saying that these were all utter masters of their instruments and music,
right,
in general. I mean, music writ large. They could have played straight-ahead jazz very easily if that had been their decision. They could have been members of symphony orchestras, but they chose this way of being musicians. And then you also made the point that any one of them could have, you know, given their talents and their intelligence and their resourcefulness, could have had a career in a corporate sense, you know, and you know, made a lavish living. But instead, they were so committed to this thing that they were doing, basically improvised music, and incorporating all the elements of art, which is why they didn't call themselves the music ensemble or the jazz ensemble, they called themselves the art ensemble.
Right. And I don't think we should assume that these guys were, you know, just impoverished. They were definitely struggling for a little while in the 60s and 70s. You know, that was the period when they were trying to get their music, you know, spread throughout Chicago and the U.S., throughout the world. You know, that was their period of really a scuffling, so they could then, you know, get into bigger and better things. You know, by the end of the 70s, they were making a lot of money recording for, you know, major labels. They were touring the world. They were making all kinds of money just in the U.S. So, I mean, you know, Lester and Roscoe were well known for, you know, driving Lexuses and having, you know, expensive watches and, you know, having the best cigars and the best cognac. These guys actually lived very well. The art ensemble made enough money for these guys to live, maybe not in the top 1%, but they did very, very well for themselves. They might have been able to do as well or better in some other areas, but it was also important that they, you know, make the kind of music and do the kind of performing that was so important to them. So maybe it took a little bit longer, you know, to build that audience and to really get into another, you know, level within the music industry, but it did happen, you know. So they weren't, in contrast to maybe, you know, groups like Sun Ra, which were pretty much always, you know, dealing with a subsistence type existence. You know, the art mm-hmm. ensemble rocketed past that relatively quickly, you know, given what they were doing. And really thrived, you know, really did big things, had nice big houses, you know, outstanding automobiles, all the things that you kind of want, you know, when you hit the middle of your career, in the middle of your lifespan. These guys lived very well without apologies, and, you know, they were into being successful. They were not into the starving artist thing. You know, they scuffled for a little while, but they were into really living well and just, you know, having the best of everything on and off stage.
Well, they paid their dues, and they, you know, instead of going on a blazed trail, you know, that, you know, a trail that was already, you know, just start going down, that they had to create a trail out of a wilderness, really, because there wasn't necessarily any clear. And I guess this is the point that I'm trying to make, maybe for young musicians starting out, is, and I think the Art Ensemble is an example to a super degree, which is, you know, you've got to go out there and create the structures for yourself. In other words, you know, nobody is going to say, okay, well, here's your tour, you know, here's the people that are going to accept you, here's a financial model that will keep you alive for several years while you're getting established, here's how to make your resources go as far, you know, it's a, not only did they improvise in music, but they improvised in just, again, that word logistics, and in organization, and in business. I think they did a great job on the business side as well.
Right.
Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to, so I want to tell everybody about the book. It's called Message to Our Folks, The Art Ensemble of Chicago. It's by Paul Steinbeck, which Paul and then Steinbeck. It's published by the University of Chicago Press, and you can get it directly from them at press.uchicago.edu. I recommend, you know, get it straight from the publisher, and I always have to applaud the publishers who make books like this possible, because these are really important books. This is very important information for fans, for aspiring musicians, or just anybody that wants to know how things actually really worked in the real world. Now, in your other life, you're a professor of music theory at Washington University in St. Louis.
Yes. Yeah, that's one of my many other lives. I'm also a bassist. I perform occasionally, but in the classroom, you know, I'm a professor of music theory. So, but all these things are kind of related. You know, as a performer, you have to know theory. As a theorist, you have to be able to relate to musicians and break music down analytically. And then that also feeds into my research and writing. So these are really just different facets of, you know, a larger pursuit. But yes, I do indeed have a day job as a professor.
And now this may seem like a strange question, but some people don't know the answer. And it's not something that you could answer, you know, fully in a short time. It takes semesters to get the answer. But music theory, what, for someone that's a non-musician, what is music theory, and why do people study it, and how does it help? Does it help musicians, and how does it help them?
Music theory is indispensable to really any working musician or any scholar of music. Music theory is just about studying the structures behind any style of music. So whether it's jazz or classical or something else, there's often a reason why one note goes to the next note, or this rhythm can generate another rhythm. Theory is all about just understanding, you know, the background to how any music sounds. And so if you're a performer, improviser, if you're interpreting written music, you know, theory will help you understand why, you know, this twist or this turn happened in this piece, or why you might want to choose to do this as an improviser. If you're a scholar, understanding music theory allows you to pick up a score or listen to a recording or go to a concert and be able to follow along, you know, at a level that you might not be able to if you don't appreciate and have some understanding of music theory. So, you know, theory is really a crucial discipline for any musician or any lover of music, and it's been important to me, and it also, you know, it also is a thing that I do professionally. So, in reference to the Art Ensemble of Chicago, it allowed me to, you know, listen to some of their performances, concerts, and recordings, and be able to, you know, really get in and start asking some questions about the music, and ultimately to the members of the Art Ensemble, hey, why did you do that? And I could think of some alternatives, or why did you play this composition after that one? Why did the improvisation go in this direction? Music theory really allowed me access, you know, to the sounds in a way that would allow me to, you know, have these conversations with the band and really get their perspective on how the music unfolded.
Got you. Gives you sort of a language to talk about the sounds.
Yes, very much so. Very much.
And you went as far as getting a PhD in music theory. Is that right?
Yeah. That's one of the things you have to do if you want to become a professor. So I went to the University of Chicago as an undergrad, and then Columbia University in New York as a graduate student. Went all the way through. I can't get any more degrees. I'm topped out. You know, after the PhD, you just stop. But I did go down that route. It's been incredibly rewarding, and it didn't even cost me that much credibility in the, you know, performance world.
Just don't let them know. Don't let them know you did it. Now, to get a PhD, you do a thesis. What was your thesis on?
It was actually about the art ensemble. So my art ensemble research got started, you know, way back when I was in graduate school. You know, and I think I went into the subject to a certain degree and went in with a certain depth. But when I had the time to really sit down and think about what I wanted an art ensemble book to be about, then I started asking a whole other set of questions and started doing more reading, more interviews, and everything that went into that. So, but I had always known that the art ensemble was going to be something I was going to write about. It showed up in graduate school, but it sort of took over my life in the last 4 to 5 years as I put this book together.
And when did you first encounter them as a band?
There have been a few different moments. I think the first time I heard the art ensemble perform together was in 2006. I was living in New York, and they were playing at Iridium in Midtown. So that was a wonderful week of performances that I'll definitely never forget. And ever since then, I've tried to find opportunities to hear either the band as a whole or the individual members in their own side projects. But I, you know, as an undergrad, I lived in Chicago. And so, you know, Joseph Drummond was always coming through town. Roscoe Mitchell was always passing through to play concerts. Famidou Don Moyer was always playing. Malachi Favors, as well as Moyer, lived down the street from me, actually. And I, the first time I think I encountered any member of the band, I was just in the grocery store in the bread aisle, and Malachi Favors was, you know, right there picking up a loaf of something or other. And I'm a bass player myself. He's the art ensemble's bassist, and he had been my hero ever since I started listening to the group. So, you know, to just stumble across Malachi Favors in the unlikeliest place was just amazing. So, of course, I had to introduce myself and bow down and just say how excited I was, you know, to get a chance to shake his hand and all that. You know, but these guys are just out in the world doing what they do. So I've had the opportunity to get to know, you know, all of them with the exception of Lester Bowie, who died back in 1999. But I've had wonderful encounters and ongoing relationships with everybody else. And it's, you know, it's really been an honor to get to know them personally and professionally as well. But just on a personal level, these are some great human beings, you know, and it's an honor to just be in their orbit.
Well, I'd like to read something that they had to say about you. This is what Roscoe Mitchell said about your book and your work. I would like to express my sincere gratitude to Steinbeck for message to our folks. This book is more than we could have hoped for. That doesn't happen very often in life. It's more than we could have hoped for. Telling the complete history of the art ensemble of Chicago in careful, engaging detail. And again, that's pretty high praise. And believe me, he wouldn't say it if he didn't feel it and believe it. So it's wonderful for these artists to have their work documented in such a thorough way. And also, I want to say again, for fans of music, this is one of the great American music stories, this art ensemble of Chicago and how they came together in the mid-60s. And bit by bit carved out a space for themselves in the world that was satisfying creatively, but also allowed them to make a very handsome livings, and also opened the doors for many, many, many other artists. And I especially think young people, if you have a young person in your life who wants to become a musician, get them this book so they can see what's possible when you use your full creative mind, because clearly the art ensemble did that. Paul, thanks a lot for writing this book and documenting this story. It's really important. And
I appreciate you saying that. I do think that your listeners will get a lot out of it if they're able to check the book out. You can definitely get it straight from the publisher. It's of course available at Amazon and all kinds of bookstores around the U.S. and around the world. So wherever you are, you shouldn't be that far from picking up a copy of Message to Our Folks.
Great. And if you're a student, and we do have a lot of students, we actually have a lot of teachers and professors that listen to Jazz on the Tube, go to your library, your school's library, and explain to them that this is sort of a kind of a key book on many different levels, and you know, understanding the avant-garde movement in American music, but also understanding the logistics and practicality of keeping a musical unit alive and thriving for decades. This really should be on the shelf of every academic library, because it's important stuff. This kind of material doesn't get recorded very often, and it's very important that it does. So, Paul, thank you so much for the time and this very interesting and that talk. I wish everybody who's listening could have gone to Bard, but I just wanted to and hear you speak at Bard. Are you going to be speaking any other places, by the way, that we could let people know about?
I'm going to be in St. Louis, which is my hometown. Later this year, I'm going to be at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore in Chicago in September. I'm doing a book signing and talk in conjunction with the Hyde Park Jazz Festival. I believe I'll be in Italy the month after that in October. So all kinds of places. If you go to paulsteinbeck.com, which is my website, you should be able to see all my public appearances. So please come out and say hello, and I'll sign a book for you or do anything. You know, it'd be great to meet some more readers. So far, the readers have been very positive. But I always like to hear from that next person to see what they think about this book.
Great. We'll put that link underneath the interview. So it's paulsteinbeck.com. And
yes,
definitely,
sir.
Well, pardon me?
I said, yes, sir. Thank you for doing your part and spreading the word.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And really, guys, if Paul's anywhere near you, this is a good talk to go to. He has video. He does a little bit of music theory, but theory in such a way that even a layman who doesn't have, you know, chops in that area can follow. It's a really multifaceted, fascinating talk and a great introduction to the book. So great. So paulsteinbeck.com, and we've been talking with Paul Steinbeck about his new book, Message to Our Folks, The Art Ensemble of Chicago. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thank you, Ken.